This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Science Journal, an audio journal production presenting articles of interest from science magazines, newspapers, and online resources on topics such as technology, health, and the environment. Material is selected with the interests of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. This program is supported in part by Cognex and UMass Medical School. Our program today will bring you articles from the New York Times, The New Yorker, The Smithsonian, New Scientist, and Science Daily. This is Tricia Droney, and today I will start with a kind of fun behind-the-scenes article about the World Cup entitled The Scientific Quest for a Perfect World Cup Field by Alan Burdick of New York Times Science Section, published on June 14, 2026. As you settle in to watch the world's biggest sporting event, 39 days, 48 teams, 104 matches, and more than 1,200 pairs of pounding cleated feet, spare a blessing for the grass. FIFA, the international ruling body of soccer, mandates that every World Cup match be played on natural living turf. Moreover, the playing experience, including the bounce and movement of the ball and the player feel, must be consistent from venue to venue. Also, the field must be green. Achieving this is no small task. The 2026 World Cup involves 16 stadiums, 5 of them domed, 8 with permanent artificial turf that must be overlaid, across 3 countries and widely varying climates. We have this massive, massive tournament footprint, said Alan Ferguson, FIFA's senior pitch management manager. Trying to bring that together in a uniform manner has been our biggest challenge. Under Mr. Ferguson's guidance, FIFA has assembled a crack team of turfologists led by John Sorokin at the University of Tennessee and John Rogers at Michigan State University. They've been working since 2018 to determine how best to achieve the green dream. Here's where they have landed. There are 24 species of turf grass. None are created equal. Kentucky bluegrass is a cold weather species adapted to lower light levels and shorter growing seasons. Bermuda grass, a warm climate grass, can't take the shade. Perennial ryegrass, a cold weather bunch grass, germinates quickly but is more vulnerable to divots. Both Bermuda grass and Kentucky bluegrass grow laterally and can be cropped closely, ideal for golf courses and soccer fields. Each of these grasses and combinations of grasses has its own growth rate, moisture requirements, and ideal mow heights, and presents different physics to the shoe. To see how various turf combinations responded to players' movements, Dr. Sorokin's team invented the Flex, a portable device outfitted with a 3D printed foot in a soccer cleat. It strikes the turf with the same impact, acceleration, and cutting motion of a 168-pound athlete, the average weight of a men's World Cup player, and then measures how much energy the turf absorbs and returns to the player. Other machines are just a vertical drop, like it's a missile or something, Dr. Sorokin said. This is the first time we've actually got something that really mimics a consistent strike of a foot. And there's the ball to consider. According to the FIFA Turf Test Manual, a FIFA-quality pro ball released onto a field from an approved 1-meter-tall apparatus, say the Turf Tech FIFA ball ramp, should roll 5 to 8 meters with tests conducted at several spots and in several directions. Likewise, a test specimen dropped vertically from 2 meters with the red drop ball rebound tester must rebound between 60 centimeters and 100 centimeters. This holds whether the surface is natural or fake, bluegrass or kikuyu, at sea level or at an elevation of 7,300 feet in Mexico City. Dr. Sorokan and his colleagues ran these tests and many more. We compared Bermuda grass versus bluegrass and ryegrass and synthetic turf, he said, and we launched a soccer ball in at 55 kilometers an hour at 17 degrees and used a high-speed camera to measure the coefficient of restitution of the ball coming out, the velocity, everything. The verdict? The open-air stadiums in Miami and Monterrey, Mexico, would use Bermuda grass, and the indoor domes and northern stadiums would use a custom mix of 84% Kentucky bluegrass and 16% ryegrass. The result, Dr. Sorokan hopes, is a playing experience that is uniform and homogeneous across all 16 stadiums. The sod for 15 stadiums was grown at 9 sod farms across Canada, Mexico, and the United States. Mexico City grew its field from seed in the stadium. For the longest journey, 24 refrigerator trucks carried rolls of sod 1,400 miles and 30 hours from Colorado to Atlanta. One innovation for 2026 is an agricultural technique known as sod on plastic. Traditionally, when sod is harvested, the roots are cut, which can lead to transplant shock, less resilient turf that takes longer to settle into its new home. For the World Cup, the grass was grown on a thin layer of sand atop a plastic sheet. The roots grow down and then sideways, intertwining into a dense, hardy mat. The sod can then be sliced, rolled up for transportation, and installed without trauma. Once in place, the sod is reinforced with plastic fibers, stitched in with a machine resembling a combination of steamroller and sewing machine. The fibers become anchors for the natural roots and act like a rebar to stabilize the field. Unlike a basketball court or a hockey rink, a soccer field is a living, breathing entity. Once the turf is installed, it must be kept alive for several weeks, an especially difficult task in domed stadiums. The advancement of stadium design kind of overtook the maintenance of the soccer field, Mr. Ferguson said. When the stadiums went to the wraparound, the enclosed roof to protect the fans and give them a better experience, they started to shut out things like air and sunlight. The temporary fields for the 2026 World Cup basically sit atop a life support system. Below the rolled out sod are several inches of sand, which provide firm cushioning, but also stays more breathable for the roots after weeks of play. Below that is a layer of either gravel or plastic, permavoid, with a drainage system that can pump water in or out. 2-ton LED grow lights are wheeled in for 12 hours a day, while industrial fans blow air across the surface to stave off fungi. Even after the tournament begins, the testing continues every day in every stadium to maintain standards. We'll keep an eye on traction, on moisture, and on surface hardness, Mr. Ferguson said, quickly adding that we don't want to adversely damage the pitches just by over-testing them. Mr. Ferguson will be watching the entire show from the FIFA Tournament Operations Center in Miami, where several dozen staff members work around the clock to monitor weather reports, flight delays, and stadium and field updates. Every minute and every second of every game I'll watch here, he said. We're looking for slips, bad bounces, something that just doesn't look quite right with the field. Hopefully we don't get a whole lot of that. Only when his native Scotland takes the field will he raise his eyes from the field itself, he said. Scotland first, pitch second in that 90 minutes. Next up, a June 10th, 2026 article by Rachel Neuer from the New York Times Science section entitled, Nearly Everyone Everywhere Veers Left When Walking. Researchers are at a loss for why people across cultures and ages, regardless of their dominant hand, have a natural bias toward wandering in a counterclockwise direction. Inaki Huarte, an applied physicist at the University of Navarra in Spain, was studying whether people maintain a certain distance between one another while walking when he noticed something strange. Across some 40 experiments, most of his participants spontaneously veered to the left. Although this observation had nothing to do with his original research, it piqued his curiosity. This was the first signal that something weird was happening, Dr. Huarte said. He and his colleagues assumed there must be a straightforward explanation. Perhaps the layout of the room, for example, was subtly directing people to list to the left. They began what they thought would be a simple investigation to find the answer. 5 years later, Dr. Huarte and his colleagues have exhausted most of their hypotheses and are no closer to solving the mystery. But what they have found, as reported on Wednesday in the journal Nature Communications, is a striking innate tendency for people across demographics, cultures, and conditions to veer in a counterclockwise direction. In principle, there is no reason for the fact that people prefer rotating counterclockwise, said Ikar Zurigal, an applied physicist at the University of Navarra and a co-author of the study. Yet it's clear they do. Dr. Zurigal and Dr. Huarte first searched in the scientific literature for an explanation as to why this might be so. They found a study showing that people who are lost usually wander in circles, but it did not specify the direction. They found another paper showing that when people encounter a wall, those who are right-handed tend to turn left, while those who are left-handed do the opposite. Most of the participants in the original study were right-handed, so the moment we saw that, we said, okay, we have an answer, Dr. Zurigal said. To check, they ran their own trial. They separated participants according to whether they turned left or right when directed to approach a wall. They then asked the participants to walk around a small arena. To the researchers' surprise, regardless of the wall-turning preferences or handedness, most chose left. This baffling finding prompted them to undertake 5 additional experiments, each targeting a different hypothesis and involving a total of 573 participants. Yet again and again, they found the same result. In an open schoolyard, for example, the researchers instructed participants to roam at will while a drone recorded their movements. Within seconds, 80% of people were moving in a counterclockwise direction. It's not a gradual drift, but rather a bias that emerges almost immediately, Dr. Huarte said. Dr. Huarte and his colleagues wondered if the behavior might be emerging collectively, similar to how pedestrians split into 2 opposite moving lanes on crowded sidewalks. But when they tested participants alone, 75% still moved counterclockwise, suggesting that the tendency is individual. Were there cultural factors behind those preferences? Pedestrians, for example, typically walk on the same side as cars drive on in their country, and pedestrians also typically move in that direction if they encounter an obstacle. So the team ran experiments in Japan, where pedestrian lanes form on the left, despite being convinced they would see the opposite pattern to the one in Spain. The researchers yet again observed participants moving counterclockwise, ruling cultural norms off the list. Finally, they wondered if some unacknowledged social convention drilled into adults, but not yet present in children, might be at play. They reached out to researchers who had conducted a prior study in a Japanese kindergarten in which 52 children moved at random while music played. The Japanese researchers shared their videos of the children for analysis, revealing that most of them also moved counterclockwise. Enrico Ronchi, who models emergency evacuations at Lund University in Sweden and was not involved in the research, said the findings open up many new interesting avenues in the field of crowd dynamics. He would be interested to see, for example, whether the counterclockwise bias holds up among people with disabilities or in emergency evacuations. Carol Basick, an applied mathematician at MIT, who was also not involved in the research, said the new findings challenges our understanding of human locomotion. The counterclockwise bias may have far-reaching consequences for everyday pedestrian traffic, but we simply have not looked for them yet, he said. Dr. Zirigal and Dr. Huarte next plan to investigate new hypotheses about the counterclockwise bias using biomechanics, virtual reality, neuroscience, or even animal behavior. Fish are the canonical animal that move in circles, Dr. Zirigal said, but whether they prefer rotating in one direction or the other, we just don't know. Next up, an article written June 12, 2026, by Emily Baumgartner Nunn, entitled Medical Cure or Designer Baby? A New Approach to Editing Embryos Ignites Debate. When scientists at Columbia University announced they had used a newer technology to precisely edit the genes of human embryos last week, they set the academic community ablaze with debate. Is this good news or bad? How fast will this move? And more philosophically, where does medicine end and eugenics begin? The results of the new study, first reported by the New York Times, showed that a technique called base editing meticulously swapped out individual letters in an embryo's genome, altering genes linked to fetal hemoglobin production, cholesterol levels, and the risk of heart disease. Though the work is still under peer review and has not been published in a scientific journal, experts from a vast array of disciplines are discussing whether the tools will bring us one step closer to curing inherited diseases or one step closer to designer babies, or both. Optimistic clinicians saw the Columbia study as a major step in medicine, bolstering their hope that scientists could one day fix embryo mutations in a clinical setting. Dr. Ellen Goldstein, a reproductive endocrinologist and fertility specialist in Los Angeles, said that for some of her patients, the tool could mean a successful pregnancy with an embryo that would have otherwise been discarded. There are very specific problems that this technology could be applied to, conditions where we all agree there are devastating consequences, she said, like Huntington's disease, which causes nerve cells in the brain to break down, or Duchenne muscular dystrophy, in which skeletal and heart muscles waste away. As a doctor, you wish you could just go in and start fixing embryos, she said. Tweaking embryos with an earlier form of gene editing, CRISPR, is considered far too risky. The tool functions like a pair of molecular scissors, hacking off long segments of DNA, sometimes in error. Researchers who tried it found their specimens with strange DNA rearrangements, large swaths missing, and in some cases, entire chromosomes destroyed. Base editing is not nearly as clunky. The Columbia researchers were in many cases able to change single letters of the genome safely, as if they had a precision eraser and a red pencil to simply correct the spelling. For proponents of the new tool, the argument is, if we could safely prevent a child from inheriting a devastating genetic condition, isn't it unethical not to? We have to be really careful not to have knee-jerk reactions to reject this kind of research, Dr. Goldstein said. As long as you're doing it with proper understanding and proper respect for the future implications and with correct oversight from biologists and ethicists. Many of those ethicists are the ones issuing caution, Dr. Lainey Freeman-Ross, a pediatrician and bioethicist at the University of Rochester, was skeptical not just of the future implications of the technology, but of the present-day work. Let us be clear, she said. Human embryos become living human persons. The research is being done on future persons without their consent. The researcher who led the project, Dieter Eagley, told the Times that a public conversation about the pros and cons of editing genes in embryos was necessary, but that as a scientist, you can provide the data for discussion, but then essentially there you stop and let others take over. Dr. Ross vehemently disagreed. This is morally irresponsible. There is no such thing as value-neutral science, she said. The team has already made an ethical decision to pursue this line of work. Geneticists, too, are tempering their excitement, arguing that the technology still has major limitations. The tweaks, though precise, only worked in a portion of the cells, which resulted in so-called mosaic embryos that contained a mix of edited and unedited cells. If one of the mosaic embryos had been implanted and led to a pregnancy, the health implications of the mix might not have become apparent for years after the child's birth. Another clinical complexity, since modern IVF usually extracts a small cluster of cells for genetic testing, the mosaic nature of an embryo could easily be missed. If the randomly selected pocket is healthy, it could offer parents false reassurance, making the mutation elsewhere. We are very far away from having safe embryonic gene editing methods where the benefits outweigh the risks, says Rasmus Nielsen, a geneticist at the University of California, Berkeley. Early embryo editing also comes with a sobering level of permanence. Unlike edits to standard body cells, any changes made to reproductive cells are passed down to future generation. That means edits or errors in a clinical setting wouldn't end with that child, but would be passed down their family line, altering the gene pool forever. How would we as a society intervene if the intervention led to serious health or reproductive consequences? We have no strategy, Dr. Ross said. This can have dire consequences for our species. Despite the risks, many experts expect a substantial commercial push, not just to make this technology available, but also to encourage it. The chief clinical officer of Nucleus Genomics was an author on the new paper, and the company announced it was proud to fund the next phase of research focused on further advancing this technology toward clinical use. At a booming moment in reproductive technology, and one at which Nucleus is among the companies at the center, some researchers worry that the initial concept of editing away disease will quickly be repurposed into a Silicon Valley push to optimize the human genome, promising wealthy parents the chance to edit for elective traits like eye color and height. Many of the eugenic traits that bioethicists worry about most, like intelligence, rely on hundreds or thousands of genes that interact with one another and a child's environment. Thus, it's highly unlikely that one-by-one base editing would be useful. But that doesn't mean companies would not capitalize on parents' hopes and fears. Given the lack of regulation around reproductive technology, says Daphne Martchenko, a bioethicist at Stanford University, it feels like only a matter of time. Another interesting health-related article is entitled, Doctors Couldn't Help Them. They Rolled the Dice with AI. Some women with complex chronic illnesses are using chatbots to search for diagnoses or relief from their symptoms. This article was written April 8, 2026 by Maggie Astor. When Margie Smith got sick in 2022, she sought help from a parade of specialists. She saw an allergist for an intractable cough, three pulmonologists for the cough and breathlessness, an ear, nose, and throat doctor for severe acid reflux, a cardiologist after she almost passed out while exercising. She got the sense that most were siloed in their specialties and couldn't assemble the full puzzle. Eventually, Ms. Smith, 70, of Swannanoa, North Carolina, turned to the AI chat box Claude. Through lengthy chats as well as a Facebook group, she concluded that she had long COVID and it was causing dystonomia, a condition common in post-viral syndromes, in which the body struggles to regulate functions like pulse, blood pressure, digestion, and temperature. Ms. Smith now goes to appointments with AI suggestions in hand, and she chooses providers in part based on whether they are receptive to its role in her decision-making. She said a combination of recommendations from doctors and from Claude had made her symptoms manageable. The medical system really failed me, she said. It is a good thing to be depending on AI for medical advice. Is it? I don't think so, but it's the option that's available. More people are asking chatbots for health advice. A third of adults use them for that purpose, according to a poll released in March. Reporting by the New York Times suggests that one notable subset is women with complex chronic illnesses, which are often poorly understood. It can take years to receive a diagnosis, much less relief. That is partly because symptoms span multiple specialties. But also, many of these illnesses, like long COVID and autoimmune diseases, disproportionately affect women, and doctors are more likely to minimize or delay treating women's symptoms. Hundreds of people responded to a request last fall to discuss how they were using AI for their health. Since then, the Times has conducted dozens of interviews about patterns that emerge. The women interviewed for this article said they knew chatbots often provided misinformation and some had encountered serious errors. Most said they would rather rely on doctors, but felt they couldn't. There are a lot of problems with using chatbots for medical advice, said James Landay, a co-director of Stanford University's Institute for Human-Centered AI. But I think we also have to admit that there's a reason people are doing this. Patients have long self-diagnosed through forums, social media, Google, and WebMD. It's easy to find patients who were dismissed by doctors, did their own research, and were proven right, as well as patients who pursued unapproved treatment plans and were catastrophically wrong. So in some ways, using AI to compensate for healthcare failures is a new version of an old story, said Dr. John Wythe, the chief executive of the American Medical Association. But the nature of the technology makes it both more powerful and more risky. Chatbots often invite people to describe their medical histories in detail, including by uploading test results. And they can offer responses that feel personalized, comprehensive, and authoritative, even when they aren't. Some startups are testing specialized AI products to help diagnose illnesses. But general purpose chatbots have not been thoroughly evaluated for personalized diagnosis and can err in significant ways, said Dr. Danielle Bitterman, the clinical lead for data science and AI at Mass General Brigham. AI models can draw from both high and low quality sources or hallucinate. Users won't always get citations unless they ask, and it takes scientific literacy to determine whether those sources are reputable and support the chatbot's claims. Chatbots can sometimes diagnose tough cases. Take Patty Costello, a user experience researcher in Idaho. More than a decade ago, Ms. Costello woke up feeling off. She would have flares of nausea, diarrhea, heartburn, and fatigue for days or weeks at a time, with respites but no long-term improvement. She saw numerous doctors who ordered a variety of tests, several of which showed signs of inflammation, but none brought a diagnosis. The flares grew more frequent. "This is ruining my life," she told ChatGPT last year, describing her symptoms and overall health and mentioning the inflammation. As one of nine possible diagnoses, the chatbot listed mast cell activation syndrome, in which mast cells, a part of the immune system, flag incorrectly that there is something dangerous in the body, causing allergic reactions with no clear trigger. Ms. Costello said that everything she read about the disease seemed to click with her symptoms. She went to an allergist with a suggestion and received an MCAS diagnosis. With medication, she estimates she's about 80% better. Ms. Costello is not alone in finding a diagnosis through AI, but her experience is not the norm. A study published in February found that when people without medical training were given detailed scenarios and told to use chatbots to identify a diagnosis and determine next steps, they reached the correct answers less than half the time. Dr. Wythe said that some patients had come to him scared of a grave illness that didn't fit their symptoms, and he knew of others who had accepted false reassurance from a chatbot and not gotten checked for something serious. And while none of the patients interviewed for this article said they had been harmed, other doctors have reported seeing patients who consumed dangerous substances or refused treatment for life-threatening conditions. A spokeswoman for OpenAI, which makes ChatGPT, referred to an earlier statement from Karen Singal, who leads the company's health team. The Times has sued OpenAI, claiming copyright infringement. OpenAI has denied the claims. Mr. Singal said that February's study design didn't match how people use chatbots in the real world. The company also noted that its models had become more advanced over time, while emphasizing that they are still not a substitute for professional medical advice. Anthropic, which makes Claude, did not respond to a request for comment. It is perhaps unsurprising that many of the success stories shared with the Times came from people with medical expertise. Carolyn Gamwell, 31, is a pelvic floor physical therapist in Denver. She has training in anatomy and physiology and regularly sees patients with chronic pain. Her own pain began when she was a teenager. She felt spasms along her spine and through her torso and pelvis, like everything twisting in on itself, she said. When she had sex, it felt like sandpaper. At 17, she was told she had anxiety. In college, fibromyalgia. In graduate school, chronic fatigue syndrome, plus psychosomatic symptoms. Then back to fibromyalgia. But she had seen fibromyalgia in her patients and didn't think the diagnosis fit. In October 2025, she described her symptoms to ChatGPT using precise medical terminology and asked for 10 possible diagnoses. Her expertise enabled her to reject many of its suggestions. Over more than 12,000 words, she pushed back on implausible diagnoses and explored ones that felt reasonable. One of ChatGPT's suggestions was pelvic congestion syndrome, a vascular disease. Ms. Gamwell sought a procedure that confirmed it. She had surgery in January and is now symptom-free. I've been wanting so badly to send a message to my primary care, but I haven't yet. To kind of be like, I told you so, she said. You were going to have me live the rest of my life in this chronic pain. She recognized that many users couldn't have prompted ChatGPT and assessed its responses as she had. How many people, she asked, would have realized that several of the suggestions made no sense. Beyond diagnosis, many people use chatbots to try to manage chronic conditions. Deborah Holcomb, 62, a former electrical engineer in San Diego, has myalgic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome, and can move around for about 30 minutes a day. She finds chatbots invaluable for identifying symptom patterns and exploring treatment options, though she doesn't make major changes without consulting a doctor. But while chatbots are trained in part on the best evidence about her disease, they are also trained on pseudoscientific ideas that spread among desperate patients, she noted, and on popular misconceptions. Ms. Holcomb was alarmed when ChatGPT suggested regular exercise, because exercise intolerance is a hallmark of her disease, and even mild activity can worsen symptoms. But she added, some doctors make the same recommendation. Samantha Allen Wright, 36, an English professor in Oskaloosa, Iowa, has used ChatGPT to look for information about managing migraines and a type of dystonomia called POTS, P-O-T-S. She said she had been struck by its uneven performance. ChatGPT has been more helpful than any provider she has seen, she said, in suggesting dietary changes for POTS that consider her preferences, frequent nausea, and migraines. At the same time, it often interprets lab results wrong by overanalyzing minor discrepancies, she said. For instance, it latched on to a triglyceride number that her doctor assured her was fine. And when she had gastrointestinal symptoms after starting a new medication, it falsely assured her they were common, citing a study. When Ms. Wright asked ChatGPT for the study, it admitted there wasn't one. Her doctor said her experience wasn't normal and took her off the medication. Like Ms. Gamwell, Ms. Wright has relevant expertise. She isn't a medical professional, but her research focuses on illness and disability. She knows how to critically review evidence. Without that, she said, how would I know if it were telling me the right thing? What we know about weight loss drugs is rapidly changing is the title of our next article by Danny Bloom, written June 8, 2026 in the New York Times. Tens of millions of people around the world are now taking drugs like Ozempic, a kind of real-time experiment that offers far more data than a carefully controlled clinical trial can. Thanks to the rapid uptake of the drugs, we now have a clearer picture than ever of their effects and the challenges that come with taking them. Usually when a new medicine happens, we have time to learn how to use it, Dr. Melanie Jay, director of the NYU Langone Comprehensive Program in Obesity, said in an interview Sunday at an American Diabetes Association conference in New Orleans. But with GLP-1 drugs, she said, everyone is kind of iterating in real time. Here's what we've learned in the process. Number one, they can treat much more than just diabetes or obesity. While these drugs were first approved to treat diabetes and then obesity, some of them have now been approved to reduce the risk of heart attacks and other cardiovascular issues and to treat sleep apnea, severe liver disease, and kidney disease. At least some of these benefits stem from weight loss itself. But researchers increasingly believe the drugs provide benefits that are completely separate from weight loss. A leading theory is that these drugs tamp down high levels of inflammation, which is tied to many chronic health issues. Scientists are also studying the potential for these drugs to treat a range of other conditions, including long COVID and substance use disorders. Emerging evidence has suggested that people on these drugs drink and smoke less and are less likely to develop substance abuse disorders, although scientists want more and larger trials before drawing that conclusion. Another lesson learned is you regain weight if you stop taking them, but not necessarily all of it. In clinical trials of injectable drugs currently on the market, people lost around 15 to 20% of their body weight on average after about 72 weeks. Some real-world studies back up those numbers, but other research suggests people tend to lose less weight. The average weight loss in some real-world trials can range between about 8 and 17%, depending on the drug and the study. The discrepancy between these numbers and the data from clinical trials is at least partly because many people stop taking the drugs, sometimes because of side effects or costs. Many people who stop taking these drugs will regain at least some of the weight they've lost, but some people have been able to sustain weight loss. One analysis of records from over 180,000 patients found that over half of those who took semaglutide, the substance in Wegovy, or tirzepatide, the compound in Zepbound, kept at least some of the weight off or even lost additional weight 2 years after stopping. Next, they don't work equally well for everyone. We know that about 1 in 10 people on the drugs are what scientists call non-responders, who lose less than 5% of their body weight. And a small portion of people who take weight loss drugs are super responders, who lose a lot of weight in a short amount of time. It isn't clear how common super responders are. Scientists think that genetics, as well as how much pleasure people naturally derive from eating, may play a role in these differing responses. Also, they can have unexpected downsides. Many people on these medications experience side effects that have been reported in clinical trials, nausea, fatigue, and digestive issues like vomiting and diarrhea. But as more people have taken the drugs, all sorts of other less common concerns have cropped up. Some of these, like Ozempic breath, caused in part by dehydration from patients with dampened appetites drinking less, or Ozempic face when losing fat leaves you looking hollowed out, have become topics of conversation on social media. Dr. Scott Hagen, an associate professor of medicine at the University of Washington, who studies obesity, has had patients complain that their hair is falling out. It is possible that this is a result of losing a large amount of weight quickly. People with anorexia also often lose some hair. Some of the issues that have emerged are more serious. A few studies have tied the use of these medications with a slightly increased risk of developing a very rare eye condition, though it isn't clear yet whether GLP-1s directly cause that condition. Doctors have also seen the drugs dial down appetite so extremely that some patients develop nutritional deficiencies. And the drugs have also been linked with a slight increase in risk for pancreatitis, though that remains extremely rare. Patients also frequently lose muscle mass on the medications. Many young, healthy patients have been able to recover muscle or preserve it in the first place by strength training and eating plenty of protein, doctors said, but they have seen older adults become more frail on these medications, making them more prone to falls. Next, the right dose is up for debate. Patients taking these drugs start at the lowest dose and then typically titrate up over the course of months. Typically, the higher the dose, the more weight patients lose and the lower their blood sugar drops. We're in this murky territory when there's lots of different doses to choose from, and the highest one might put someone at a weight that may not be good for them long term, Dr. Hagen said. Keeping patients on too high a dose can suppress their appetite to unhealthy levels, leading to nutritional deficiencies, and cause excessive weight loss that reduces bone density, leads to hormonal imbalances, and raises the risk of gallstones. Next, they affect more than just your body. As the drugs have become more popular, more anecdotes have emerged about the subtle ways they affect people's personal lives and mental health. For example, many people say the drugs have changed their sex lives, in some cases by making them feel more desirable and in other cases by dimming their libido. Some have said they feel more confident and are able to exercise and move around more easily. The idea that the drugs might diminish pleasure or even joy in some patients has shown up in other ways too. Maurice Spreckley, a researcher at the University of Cambridge studying these medications, said some patients have said they feel emotionally flatter without the delight they once found in food and less connected to the social element of eating. She said that those experiences warrant further research. Other people have said that their personality felt duller on the medications or that they felt more lethargic. It's been less than a decade since Ozempic hit the market. As more people take weight loss drugs and researchers continue to study them, we'll learn more about how these medications may change our health and the way we feel and live. Our next article is entitled, Scientists Race to Test Treatments as Ebola Outbreak Widens. This is written by Carl Zimmer and Stephanie Nolan on June 13, 2026, in the New York Times. In a hastily assembled Ebola treatment center in Rwampara, Democratic Republic of Congo, Dr. Pappas Lame and his colleagues rehydrate patients who arrive in paroxysms of diarrhea and vomiting, transfuse those who bleed uncontrollably from their noses and mouths, and provide oxygen for those in respiratory distress. They monitor patients' hearts and blood pressure and treat their intense pain. It's a significant improvement from outbreaks that Dr. Lame, the Ebola response coordinator in Congo for the Alliance for International Medical Action, worked on even 5 years ago. Today we have more options and more people survive, he said. But they are still missing something crucial, a treatment that specifically targets Bundibugyo virus, the species that has caused the current outbreak in East Africa. At least 695 people have been infected so far, and 138 have died. Scientists are searching intensely to find drugs that might work. Over the past 50 years, most outbreaks of Ebola disease were caused by a different species of virus, known as Ebola virus. Based on clinical trials, the World Health Organization recommends two drugs as treatments for Ebola virus. But just because scientists know that a drug works against one virus doesn't mean that it works against the other. The evolutionary differences are just too great. After Bundibugyo virus emerged in 2007, scientists ran preliminary experiments with cells and animals to see if any drugs could stop it. Some of those studies yielded promising results. But scientists did not push the research further because before now, there had only been two small outbreaks of Bundibugyo virus. With limited funds to perform the expensive research, they had to choose their battles. If you were a betting person, you would not have bet on Bundu Biyago to cause something large, said Thomas Geisbert, a virologist at the University of Texas Medical Branch at Galveston. And, of course, we're all wrong now. Now scientists are rushing to pinpoint drugs to test in clinical trials against Bundu Biyago virus. The WHO has put together a list of candidates for immediate trials. Scientists are also hunting for other compounds that might be worth testing. One type of drug that works against viruses is known as monoclonal antibody. This molecule locks into the surface of a virus and prevents it from getting into cells. Other drugs known as antivirals stop viruses from replicating once they have gotten inside cells. Some grab onto viral proteins, causing them to shut down. The disabled proteins can no longer do essential jobs like making new virus genes. A monoclonal antibody called MBP-134 has proved effective at stopping Bundu Biyago infections in monkeys. And in early clinical trials for Ebola virus, it has also proved safe for people to take. In a few cases, doctors are already using MBP-134 to treat Bundu Biyago infections. An American physician, Dr. Peter Stafford, received it after he became infected in Congo and was flown to Europe for treatment last month. He also received remdesivir, an antiviral drug that's been used in the past for other diseases, including COVID. It has shown promise in early studies on Bundu Biyago virus. Dr. Stafford was discharged from Charité Hospital in Berlin on June 6. It's impossible to know for certain if MBP-134 or remdesivir helped save his life. The only way to gain that kind of knowledge is through carefully designed clinical trials, comparing people who get experimental drugs with those who get only supportive care. To prioritize which drugs to test in trials, the WHO brought together experts to review preliminary studies. On May 28, they recommended moving MBP-134 and remdesivir into clinical trials, along with another monoclonal antibody, moftivimab, and another antiviral, obeldesivir. An ordinary clinical trial can take many months or even years. It takes time to get regulatory approval, organize the logistics, and find enough patients to treat. Many past Ebola outbreaks ended before clinical trials could even begin. The Bundu Biyago outbreak could be different, said Dr. Amanda Rozek, an associate professor of health emergencies at the University of Oxford and a veteran of Ebola response. She and other researchers have been developing a new kind of clinical trial that makes it possible to test a single drug in multiple outbreaks caused by different viruses. Dr. Rozek and her colleagues began a trial of remdesivir in Rwanda in 2024 during an outbreak of Marburg, another species of virus that causes a lethal disease much like Ebola. Dr. Rozek plans to combine these results with a new trial in which remdesivir will be tested against Bundu Biyago virus. While the trial design may speed up results, the current outbreak presents a host of challenges, she warned. It is taking place in an active conflict zone, and treatment centers are now only getting set up, and there is limited infrastructure to support clinical trials. Given the scope of the need for treatments, there are frustratingly few good candidates for scientists to test. There are only a limited number of candidates available for clinical trials, meaning that if these fail, there are no ready alternatives in the pipeline, said Carmen Perez Casas, the head of pandemic preparedness at the Global Health Agency UNITAID, which is trying to arrange funds for early clinical testing of possible therapeutics. Dr. Rozek's trial will test two of the treatments on the WHO priority list. Some patients will receive MBP-134, while others will receive MBP-134 plus remdesivir. We think there might be a combination effect between some of these agents, she said. The trial is in the final stages of regulatory approval. I'm pretty optimistic that remdesivir may work, said Dr. Karim, who is in Congo and leads the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Experts Group on the outbreak. It will be quite quick to show efficacy because we have the patients there in the hospital. And if remdesivir does work, it's quite a cheap drug and generics are widely available. Are there drugs that can prevent people from getting sick in the first place? Possibly. Public health workers in Congo and Uganda are tracking down people who have had contact with patients and could be affected. For now, the contacts have to wait in isolation to see if they develop symptoms. Researchers hope to test an antiviral that may lower the risk that contacts develop Ebola disease, a strategy known as post-exposure prophylaxis. The trial will last a 10-day course of obeldesivir. The drug is essentially a cheap oral form of remdesivir. This is a potential game changer, said Dr. Armand Spreacher, an epidemiologist and emergency physician with Doctors Without Borders, who has worked on half a dozen Ebola outbreaks. In somebody who is incubating illness, you could effectively cure them before they become sick. And it also means they are not in the community shedding virus. Promising hints of obeldesivir's effectiveness emerged from a study published last year by Dr. Geisberg and his colleagues. They gave monkeys obeldesivir starting just 24 hours after infection with Ebola virus, long before they would normally start showing symptoms. They were completely protected, Dr. Geisberg said. I mean, they didn't even get sick. They also tested the drug against another species of virus that causes Ebola disease called Sudan virus and against Marburg. In all three cases, obeldesivir protected the animals. But before the current outbreak, the scientists had not yet tested on monkeys infected with Bundibugyo virus. For pre-exposure prophylactics to work, a health system has to be effectively tracing contacts. An effective drug would give those directing the outbreak response something to offer people, an incentive for sick people to go into isolation wards if they know the family members who are caring for them would receive the protective pills. And finally, if any of these drugs work, will East Africans get them? The family members of Dr. Stafford, the American physician treated for the virus, were given MBP-134 in Berlin as post-exposure prophylaxis. None developed Ebola disease. As they were leaving the hospital, Dr. Stafford expressed his gratitude, but added that he hoped all patients in Congo could receive the same level of care he and his family did. Questions of access have haunted treatments tested in previous Ebola outbreaks. Dr. Rojek called post-trial access a critical issue and said it was being worked through at the moment for the therapeutics that might be tested in this outbreak. In 2019, during an Ebola outbreak in Congo, a trial funded largely by the U.S. National Institutes of Health tested four monoclonal antibody treatments. Two of the drugs cut deaths in patients by as much as 50%. One of them was developed from the blood of a Congolese Ebola survivor. And yet, despite the public funding and the local origin of the treatments, there was no guarantee that the promising drugs would be supplied in Congo. Two companies, Regeneron and Ridgeback Biotherapeutics, ended up holding the intellectual property. Neither has yet registered either drug in any of the countries where Ebola outbreaks occur. Ridgeback says it has provided one of the drugs and Suvimab free in four Ebola outbreaks in the DRC under a special access protocol, though declined to say how many patients had received it. Regeneron has a similar arrangement for its drug. The company says it has donated 500 doses to the WHO, but most of the supply of both drugs is held in the United States National Security Stockpile. And we'll finish up today with a lighter question and answer from the New York Times bestseller, The Book of General Ignorance, Everything You Think You Know Is Wrong. Today's question is, where do most tigers live? The answer, the United States. A century ago, there were about 40,000 tigers in India. Now there are between 3,000 and 4,700. Some scientists estimate that there were only between 5,100 and 7,500 wild tigers left on the planet. On the other hand, there are thought to be 4,000 tigers living in captivity in Texas alone. The American Zoo and Aquarium Association estimates that up to 12,000 tigers are being kept as private pets in the United States. Mike Tyson personally owns four of them. Part of the reason for America's enormous tiger population relates to legislation. Only 19 states have banned private ownership of tigers. 15 require only a license, and 16 states have no regulations at all. They're not particularly expensive either. A tiger cub will set you back a mere $1,000, while $3,500 will buy you a pair of Bengal tigers. $15,000 is enough for a fashionable blue-eyed white tiger. Ironically, it is the success of breeding programs at American zoos and circuses that has driven this. An overabundance of cubs in the 1980s and 90s brought the prices right down. The Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals estimates that there are now 500 lions, tigers, and other big cats in private ownership just in the Houston area. Wild tiger populations were crippled during the 20th century. Tigers were extinct around the Caspian Sea by the 1950s, and the tigers on the islands of Bali and Java disappeared between 1937 and 1972. The South China tiger is nearly extinct in the wild, with only 30 animals remaining. Despite the efforts of conservationists, all species of tiger are expected to be extinct in the wild by the end of the current century. A domestic cat is about 1% the size of a tiger. Tigers cannot abide the smell of alcohol. They will savage anyone who has been drinking. Tigers fade as they get older, and who can blame them? You have been listening to Science Journal, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call us at 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. If you have an idea for a topic to explore, please contact Audio Journal at 508-797-1117 or email at info@audiojournal.org. I'm Tricia Droney. Thanks so much for listening with us this afternoon.
Welcome to Everyday Poems for Every Day, sponsored by Audio Journal. Our poem today is On the Grasshopper and Cricket by John Keats. The poetry of earth is never dead. When all the birds are faint with the hot sun and hide in cooling trees, a voice will run from hedge to hedge about the new mown mead. That is the grasshopper's. He takes the lead. In summer luxury. He has never done with his delights, for when tired out with fun, he rests at ease beneath some pleasant weed. The poetry of earth is ceasing never. On a lone winter evening, When the frost has wrought a silence from the stove, there shrills the cricket's song, in warmth increasing ever, and seems to one in drowsiness half lost, the grasshoppers among some grassy hills. You've been listening to Everyday Poems for Every Day, sponsored by Audio Journal, and read by me, Nikki Whichelow. Thanks for listening, and may your life be filled with the wonder of poetry.